Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Safe Harbours and 6ix9ine's Chart Battle Battle. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Andy.
We are returning to our normal format this week after 2 weeks looking at how the streaming music industry is constructed. Do go back and listen to those episodes if you haven't. That debate is still very much raging. But this week we are going to be looking at some of the biggest and most interesting music business news stories of the last week. A week when, as I just said, the debate around artist and songwriter royalties from streaming continued.
It certainly did. I've now had that conversation with so many different people, so many different times. I seem to always play whenever I'm having that conversation, because obviously I talk to all the different stakeholder groups in the music industry, and they're all having this conversation, albeit generally behind closed doors. And I always seem to find myself playing devil's advocate, whoever I'm talking to in the room. I find it really hard because I've been talking about, writing about, researching all this for so long now, and I've heard every side's arguments in so much detail that when I'm in a room full of labels, I get very vigilante about the heritage artists and the session musicians. And when I'm in a room full of artists, I say, ah, but what you don't understand is, and when I'm with the songwriters, I'm like, ah, royalty chains. So I don't know where you invoice when you are the devil's advocate. Can I send a bill to the devil to get some money in for that? But yes, the conversation's ongoing. As we discussed in detail in those two special editions you just mentioned, the whole what we call digital pie debate is very complicated because of complexities around how the streaming business works, how the deals are structured, how the money flows. It's a complicated debate. And, you know, most of the people within the industry participating in that debate, whether that's artists, songwriters, managers, labels, publishers, etc., understand certainly that there are complexities, even if they don't completely understand how each of those complexities work. But all those complexities are part of the conversation, except when the debate spills over into the pages of newspapers or onto the BBC, where generally speaking, all the complexities get stripped out and it all becomes about Spotify doesn't pay artists. It's always Spotify, isn't it? Spotify doesn't pay artists. Here's an artist who had 1 billion streams on Spotify and got paid 82 pence. How can that possibly be? That's the sort of things that you get in newspapers and on BBC when this is debated. So therefore, it was interesting this week to see the Entertainment Retailers Association here in the UK, which counts many of the streaming services, including Spotify, as its members. The boss of ERA, Kim Bailey, put a blog post on her organisation's website basically presenting the streaming services side to this argument. And whether or not you agree with what Kim wrote, I thought it was a really good piece. I thought there were some very interesting lines in there. I thought it was cleverly, in a way, aligning the streaming services with the artists. So as I say, you don't have to agree with what she wrote, but it's definitely worth checking it out. And then we also dissected that and added some extra context in our report on it in the CMU Daily. But yeah, I think those two podcasts that we put out over the last couple of weeks are going to be quite relevant to an ongoing debate for quite a few weeks, if not months ahead, I would suspect. But we talked about that so much on the last two editions of Setlist, we thought that other than in this intro section, we wouldn't dwell on that this week.
No, actually this week we're going to be discussing 6ix9ine's beef with Ariana Grande over her chart position last week in the US. But first, the US Copyright Office has finally published the report based on its review of the safe harbor that sits in America's Digital Millennium Copyright Act. This is a report we've been waiting for a long time. I think if you go back into the Setlist archives, a very, very, very long way. We have talked about this before, but yeah, you might be scrolling back for quite a way because this all started a long time ago.
Yeah, this is a formal review of the so-called copyright safe harbor, specifically the American copyright safe harbor, that was instigated, I think, initially at the request of a couple of the committees in US Congress. And then in America, they have this thing called the Copyright Office that oversees all copyright matters. So the Copyright Office, right at the end of 2015, so that's 5 years ago, said, right, we're going to do a review of the copyright safe harbor in American copyright law. Everybody should send in their submissions. Everybody did. It instigated a little bit of safe harbor shouting, YouTube bashing amongst the American music community in 2016. Then towards the end of that year, The Copyright Office then called for a second round of submissions. They basically said, oh, we thought of some extra questions. So they put some extra questions to everybody. That was the end of 2016. And then pretty much ever since then, we've been waiting for the report that summarises what everyone had said and made some proposals. And I think 2 years ago, at the big press briefing that the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry usually does when it puts out its big stats pack. And of course, for a number of years, whenever the IFPI put out its stats that said how well streaming was doing, it was always accompanied by a safe harbour moan. Oh, but we could be doing so much better if it wasn't for the safe harbour. And I do remember Francis Moore from IFPI, I say at least a couple of years ago, saying, oh, we are hoping that this report's going to finally come sometime this year. It did not. But May 2020, we finally have the report on the Safe Harbour review that began at the very start of 2016.
So despite the length of time we've been waiting for this report, it doesn't actually propose any particularly radical changes to the Safe Harbour. But it does say that Congress might want to do some fine tuning to better balance the interests of technology companies and copyright owners. Meanwhile, the music industry has used the arrival of the report as an excuse to put out a big long list of copyright gripes that it has, of which Safe Harbour is always one.
Yeah, so I suppose it's worth just spending a few minutes, rather than forcing our listeners to go back 3-4 years in the archive, to find the last time we talked about this. Let's very quickly recap what the Safe Harbour is. You wouldn't actually have to go that far back into the archives because, of course, while the Safe Harbour debate in America has kind of been on hold for 4 years while we've been waiting for this report, the Safe Harbour debate in Europe went massive, and we talked about that an awful lot on Setlist. The Safe Harbour is the thing in copyright law that says that an internet company whose users, whose customers, uses that internet company's servers or networks in order to distribute copyright-protected material without permission, without license, so therefore infringing copyright. What the Safe Harbour says is that while the copyright owner could still go and find the individual who is sharing that content without permission and sue them for copyright infringement, they can't sue the platform for copyright infringement, even though it was the platform's server and networks that allowed the infringement. The internet company has protection from liability for that copyright infringement on one condition, and that condition is that the internet company has a system in place whereby copyright owners can say, hey, that user over there or on your server or your network there, there's a bit of our content that shouldn't be there. It does not have our permission to be there. You've got to remove it. And providing the internet company has that takedown system in place, then they have this safe harbour protection. They cannot be sued for copyright infringement. And the safe harbour originates in 1990s law. So in America, it came through the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. In the European Union, it came through an e-commerce directive. And in a way, it's a sensible piece of legislation at face value, because basically what happened in the late 90s was internet companies said to lawmakers, we're about to make the internet available to everybody. Prior to that, the internet had only really been available to big business and academia and government. But as we got to the moment in history where these companies were going to make internet access available to everybody, they basically said to lawmakers, if by doing that, we can be held liable for all of these people's copyright infringement, because we all know as soon as they get internet access, the first thing they're going to do with it is infringe some copyrights. And if we can be held liable for that, then that liability is so large that this isn't going to work and we won't be able to make internet access available to everybody. So we need to have some protection. So that protection was put into law. That was sensible. And we should stress, the music industry has never objected to the principle of safe harbour in its totality, although there are some elements of safe harbour that the music industry doesn't like. And actually, although we said that we weren't going to talk about the whole streaming royalties debate today, some of the music industry, particularly the record companies, would probably say, well, actually, these things we don't like about safe harbour, the reason we don't like them is because of the impact it has on the money that comes in from the streaming services and how all of that gets distributed. So in some ways, actually, this is all part of the streaming royalties debate. But yeah, I guess there are two particular grievances that the music industry has with the bloody safe harbour.
Yeah, so the first is that the music industry would argue that a lot of companies that use the safe harbour don't have very efficient systems via which copyright owners can request that infringing content is taken down. They might get one specific piece of infringing content taken down, but invariably it'll then just pop back up again. So it's a constant game of whack-a-mole where you take something down in one place and it just reappears again. And it's a constant ongoing battle just on that one piece of content, then multiply that by all pieces of content. And you've got a lot of takedown notices. So they would prefer a system where, by law, once something has been taken down, it has to stay down. Whereas currently, the DMCA is a bit vague on what a takedown system really constitutes, what you actually have to have in place to be in line with the law. The second big grievance is the range of internet operations that can claim safe harbour protection. In particular, the music industry has argued that safe harbour protection should not apply to user upload platforms like YouTube and sites like that, that allow users to upload audio or video, but then re-aggregate all that through search tools, homepages, playlists, and basically make themselves kind of an internet version of radio or TV. And as you say, the DMCA was conceived in the 90s, and therefore it wasn't intended for this sort of operation because the lawmakers didn't conceive of this sort of operation.
Yeah, and obviously the music industry's big battle over safe harbour, both in Europe and the US and elsewhere, has usually been portrayed as the music industry versus YouTube, somewhat sensationally, although we did have a CMU lockdown webinar all about safe harbour that we called The Music Industry versus YouTube. So we've been responsible for that as well. But with those two different grievances you've just set out, I mean, I guess when it comes to the takedown, stay down, horrible whack-a-mole thing that people talk about, the beef there isn't really with YouTube, because arguably in Content ID, YouTube's rights management system, they've got a pretty good system for getting content not only removed, but for keeping that content off the platform. It's not perfect, obviously. There is the issue that actually smaller rights owners often don't get access to Content ID. But nevertheless, in Content ID, YouTube has a pretty good takedown system. So when it comes to that first grievance, actually, the music industry is much more likely to moan about the Google search engine, where it's much harder to get takedown and stay down than they are YouTube. But yeah, obviously, with the second, almost by definition, given that the argument is safe harbour should never have applied to those user-generated content platforms, user upload platforms that then re-aggregate the content, and although obviously there are lots of those platforms, YouTube is the biggest, and certainly back in 2016 when this consultation was happening, and then in much of the debate that followed in Europe around the Copyright Directive, which sought to reform the safe harbour in the European Union, certainly it did very much become the music industry versus YouTube.
So anyway, this new report, in that the Copyright Office says that with the original legislation, Congress sought to balance the needs of online service providers with those of creators. And then it goes on to say that with the submissions it received in 2016, it received dramatically varied opinions on whether that intended balance had been achieved.
Yeah, needless to say, the submissions, of which there were many, that were sent to the Copyright Office back in 2016 on this issue can be split into two groups. You had a load of submissions from technology companies who all said, it's all fine, it all works brilliantly. Congress got it so right and it's all been implemented in the best possible way. And then you had lots of submissions by copyright owners, including the music industry, particularly the music industry, saying it's all screwed up, it completely makes copyright unenforceable, it's unfair, particularly on smaller rights owners, it definitely needs to be changed.
Yes, but we know that those are the arguments of the music industry and the tech industry because they make those arguments all the time, even when you haven't asked for them. But what we want to know is what the Copyright Office thinks. And in the report, it says, based upon its own analysis of the present effectiveness of the safe harbour rules, the office has concluded that Congress's originally intended balance has been tilted askew. However, the office is not recommending any wholesale changes to the safe harbour, instead electing to point out where Congress may wish to fine-tune the current operation.
Yeah, so I suppose to conclude what is actually quite a long report in a couple of sentences, they're basically saying that it's not quite right, a few tweaks need to be made, mainly to the copyright owner's benefit, not entirely, but mainly to the copyright owner's benefit, but that they're not proposing a radical overhaul of the American safe harbour. More, well, fine-tuning, as you say, is the word that they use. The report then says if Congress decides that it should fine-tune the safe harbour, here's a list of things that possibly need fine-tuning. So it talks about possibly them needing to be more clarity about the kinds of services that qualify for safe harbour protection, saying that the current categories that are set out in law are possibly hard to interpret. It said something on repeat infringer policies, which are also part of the safe harbour. Although we talked about having to have a system in place so that copyright owners can have content removed, there's also actually another obligation, which is if an individual customer or user is constantly infringing copyright, then each safe harbour joining company should have a policy on what to do with those repeat infringers. Some of the big court cases in the US in recent years around safe harbour, the ones involving Cox Communications, Grande Communications, Charter Communications, have really been focusing in on that, the repeat infringer policies. And the Copyright Office was saying that possibly there needs to be a bit more clarity on what those repeat infringer policies should look like. Then possibly should be more transparency in terms of safe harbour dwelling companies being more clear to the wider world what their repeat infringer policies are. It also talks about wanting more clarity regarding what constitutes a safe harbour dwelling website having knowledge of infringing content on its platforms, which it does talk about in the DMCA. There's the difference between having actual knowledge and what's sometimes referred to as red flag knowledge. And I suppose for the music industry, this is an extension in a way of the takedown, stay down argument, which is that platforms shouldn't just be specifically removing bits of content for each takedown that it receives. It should be slightly more proactive than that. So, for example, if it's really obvious that a load of content that's being uploaded is clearly infringing content, then maybe it should be doing something about that. So there's a bit of a conversation around that. It also says maybe there could be more clarity on what information a copyright owner should be providing as part of the takedown system. And then it does also talk about something which almost skews the other way, which is to say this is one of the concerns of the technology lobby, which is, are copyright owners abusing takedown systems or being a bit slack when they're issuing the takedowns, which is an issue which actually is at the heart of an ongoing legal battle between the Recording Industry Association of America and a mixtape sharing platform called Spinrilla that we've been reporting on in the CMU Daily. But the idea that maybe there should be more clarity on the obligations of copyright owners who are issuing takedown notices to make sure that they are doing so accurately, that they're not misrepresenting anything. Or one of the things it talks about is maybe the current rules on that are okay, but the sanctions for takedown should be more severe. So basically, that's a bullet point list of things that Congress might want to think about and talk about and consider as part of this so-called fine-tuning of the American safe harbour. But it, as we've already mentioned, it does stress that it's not proposing a radical overhaul of safe harbour, which is interesting because pretty much every American music industry trade organisation, certainly on the copyright side of the business, issued a statement in the response to this safe harbour report. And if you read quite a few of those statements and you hadn't read the report, you'd be forgiven for thinking that what the Copyright Office had concluded is that the safe harbour is utterly screwed and needs to be completely rewritten, which is not what the Copyright Office have said. Although they have said potentially some fine-tuning, and of course, that opens up the door for going to Congress itself and saying, OK, the Copyright Office says there are issues with safe harbour, we should be putting this onto the agenda in Congress to possibly reform some law, which obviously is what the music industry would like. Hence why, as well as issuing quotes about the publishing of this report, all of those trade organisations also set out their top three piracy slash copyright gripes for 2020.
Yes, because who doesn't love a chart in the music industry? So here we go. The top three things that the music industry would like to be discussed if and when Congress gets around to debating this. So basically, they would like a takedown and stay down system, an end to stream ripping, and more and wider access to content ID style monitoring tools.
Yeah, those are the big three. Not really any surprises there. As we said from the off, we already knew that takedown, stay down is one of the big things that the music industry would like. More tools for monitoring the content that's being uploaded to user upload sites and to social media. So as I say, that's basically YouTube's content ID. YouTube has a pretty good system in content ID, although there are two things there. One is, but we would like to see other social media and user upload sites, Twitter, TikTok, etc., do more work in that space. Also, there is the gripe that, as I sort of alluded to earlier, not everybody in the music industry has access to Content ID, and that maybe smaller rights owners and self-releasing artists, self-publishing writers should have access to it as well. So that's one of the things in the top three. Yeah, and then in the middle, even though it's not really anything to do with Safe Harbor, we had a stream ripping moan.
Yeah, that being the big piracy gripe of the last few years, the existence of sites that allow you to rip audio and video from sites like YouTube. The music industry would really like those to go away. It sees them as the biggest piracy battle of the moment. I mean, some of those sites do get shut down either by being blocked or being given court orders, but it's still a problem. And so the music industry is thrown into this debate, even though, as you say, it's not entirely relevant.
So there we have the music industry's wish list on what should happen next. Whether or not Congress does anything with this report, reads this report, remains to be seen. The subcommittee on IP in the Senate has been instigating a few discussions in recent months on the DMCA and specifically Safe Harbor. So there have been some conversations more recently in Congress. So I assume the music industry will be hoping that with that conversation already ongoing in Senate and with this report now being published, now is the time to try and push for some Safe Harbor reform in the US, possibly similar to what has happened in Europe. Although, of course, there are all sorts of reasons why that might not happen. I mean, A, everyone is still very distracted with COVID-19 at the moment. B,
yeah, there's a pandemic going on right now. I don't know if you noticed.
On top of the pandemic.
I think that's the issue, isn't it? You wait 5 years. The report was already delayed kind of because of a change in president. And then now it's arrived in the middle of a pandemic. And also, we're about to possibly have another change of president.
Yeah, there's a presidential election coming up that will screw with all of that. Meanwhile, the tech lobby will almost certainly say, well, it's the Copyright Office. They always side with the copyright owners because that's what they exist to do. That will be one thing I'm sure the tech lobby will say. They'll probably also say, well, there's been these reforms in Europe. We really ought to see whether or not those reforms work, whether they achieve what the copyright owners want, whether they do screw up any internet businesses. We should definitely wait and see what happens in Europe before we do anything over here. By which they mean, let's wait 5 years to see if anything happens. Yeah. Another 5 years. So it will be interesting to see what happens next. If it does get on to the congressional agenda, possibly after this year's presidential election, then it will be interesting to see what exact positions the two sides in this battle take. The tech lobby is phenomenally powerful in Washington, and in a weird sort of way, if we did end up with a Democratic presidency at the end of this year, they're probably more likely to be swayed by the tech lobby than the current presidency of the United States. So yeah, it really remains to be seen whether or not this even gets to be a conversation in Washington, and specifically what arguments will each side present. Yes, we have this top three wish list from the music industry, but everything's in flux, isn't it? I mean, things like, even as the European Copyright Directive was reaching its final stages, some people in the music industry started to shift their position on YouTube, even though it had all been presented as the music industry versus YouTube. As I say, arguably with user upload platforms, if you look at what TikTok does, what's becoming part of the user upload experience increasingly is that the app provides a library of music, editing tools. The minute as an app you provide a music library and editing tools, you can no longer rely on Safe Harbor anyway. So the issues around the music industry's negotiating power being weakened when they try and do deals with these platforms because of Safe Harbor possibly falls away anyway. So it might be that the Safe Harbor priorities of the music industry shift more onto search engines. Or, of course, I think there's a whole conversation still to be had about the licensing of live streaming, which has become much more newsworthy in recent weeks. And it may be that it's the live streaming sites and not the user upload sites that end up being the bigger part of this debate if it reaches Congress in the US. But anyway, that report is out there. If you're interested, download your free copy from the Copyright Office website and see which side of the argument you're most convinced by.
And finally this week, having been released from prison on house arrest, rapper 6ix9ine has restarted his career with the release of his new single Goober. And it's been very popular, although it did not, as he had hoped, go to number one in the Billboard Hot 100 singles chart in the US. And boy, was he unhappy about that. Prior to the chart even being published, he put up a video on his Instagram profile complaining that Ariana Grande had bought her way to number one and done him out of his rightful position in the chart.
Yeah, because in that edition of the Billboard Hot 100 chart, Ariana Grande's collaboration with that Justin Bieber, a track called Stuck With You, a charity track called Stuck With You, was at number one in the Hot 100. Not 6ix9ine's track. Actually, 6ix9ine's track wasn't even at number two.
No, it was actually at number three, but clearly when he put out that initial rant, he was expecting it to be pushed down to number two. But actually, Doja Cat was at number two, but he didn't release any rants about her, as far as I know. But it did prompt a lot of responses and denials of any wrongdoing and lifted the curtain a bit to show you some of the workings behind how people boost their chart positions. Now, as we've said, Justin Bieber was on this track and Ariana Grande was on this track. And it was a charity single. Two of those things 6ix9ine left out entirely out of his rant, which I think would be valid reasons for this to go to number one ahead of him. But he made some strong accusations against Ariana Grande and her team. I mean, particularly, he put up another post saying it wasn't a beef specifically with Ariana Grande, but more her management. But he claimed that 60,000 sales of Stuck With You were submitted for chart eligibility at the last minute. 30,000 of those had been bought with just 6 credit cards. Something he claimed that his team had worked out through some sort of independent investigation. He wasn't very clear about how he'd got that number. I mean, he wasn't very clear about a lot of things in this, but we can come to that. He said that they'd questioned Billboard about how this could have happened, how 30,000 singles could have been bought with just 6 credit cards. And Billboard, he claimed, had just said, we can't disclose that information.
Yeah, so some bold allegations by 6ix9ine, as you say, before the chart had even been published. Bold enough that we have had formal responses not only from Billboard itself as the publisher of the chart, but both Ariana Grande and Justin Bieber subsequently responded as well. As you say, it was an interesting rant on 6ix9ine's part, because in some ways, if we ignore the fact that what got to number one was the charity record, but I mean, in some ways, it is true that Ariana Grande and Justin Bieber's management team, which are of course the same management team, although they didn't break the rules, I think that's pretty certain. He reckons that they did. That whole 30,000 copies were bought with 6 credit cards. We don't even know where he got that from. That is very strongly denied. It definitely looks like no rules were broken, no Billboard chart rules were broken, although there were some sneaky tactics employed to ensure that Bieber and Grande got to number one, which actually, had he honed in on that rather than this conspiracy theory, would have made this possibly a legitimate complaint. But he didn't really hone in on that. Actually, he spent most of his time talking about apples.
Yes. Now, I was thinking that I could actually just cut in the audio from his video at this point, but I think it would be funnier if I just read the quote as written. So he said, "It's like looking at an apple, right? An apple sometimes is almost likely red, right? There's green apples, but just look at this. There's apples that are red, right? And you're looking at an apple, and this is what we did with Billboard. Yo, explain how you deduct. If there's 50 million streams, right, on Goober, why you only count 30 million, right? So then looking at Apple saying, I'm obviously looking at you and you're red, but you're not. But you're telling us you're not red. You got caught cheating red-handed, right?" So I think that's all very clear.
Yes, so that clears all that up.
But he does mention in there the streams as well, which is another one of his accusations against Billboard, was that Billboard had discounted a load of his streams on the track in order to push him down the chart. Another thing that Billboard very much denies, pointing out that, yes, his track had been very popular on streaming services, but it's a US chart and only counts US streams, which is why not all of his streams were counted. I mean, there are other reasons for that as well. They only count verifiable streams and streams that fit within their rules, because there are rules for the number of streams any one person can play. And for that reason, Billboard says his streaming figures don't come up to the levels he was expecting. There's also the fact that they said that although he was holding this spreadsheet and waving his finger at it in his rant, they said that was a chart prediction that doesn't come from us. That's someone else's chart prediction and does not reflect the real numbers that we count.
Yes, I suppose in Billboard's response, there were a few things they were saying. First of all, what you've just said, which is as an artist, yes, you get streaming data from your distributor and from the services. Some of that streaming data is public, but you have to remember that even if you've got massive stats for streaming, first of all, often they're global stats and a US chart only counts US stats. B, yeah, what the chart compilers, Billboard and its partners in this do with those stats is very specific. It doesn't count all the stats equally, but crucially, everybody is subject to the same rules. So there was all of that. And then, of course, there was this separate issue of these supposed last-minute 60,000 sales, not streams, sales of the Bieber Grande track. Even if we ignore the allegation that 30,000 of those were bought on 6 credit cards, there is still the issue of, well, where did this last-minute 60,000 sales come from? No one is denying that there wasn't a last-minute 60,000 sales added to the tally for the Bieber Grande track. And that was, I guess, where potentially he could have had a legitimate moan, because that is where Ariana and Justin's management team did employ some rule-compliant but nevertheless sneaky promo tactics to assure that their clients got the top spot in the chart.
Now, once again, let's reiterate that this is a charity single, so maybe give it a little bit of leeway. But it does highlight tactics that can be employed to boost your chart position right at the last minute. So what Ariana and Justin did right at the last minute, with 24 hours to go before the cutoff for that week's chart, they put up for sale online a signed CD single version of the track. It was only available in the US and specifically limited to 4 per customer, which might seem odd, but it does mean that all those sales would therefore be chart compliant, because they would only be sold in the US, they would be sold within the eligibility period for that week's chart. And crucially, 4 is the most amount of singles that one person can buy to make them chart eligible. So if every fan bought 4 copies of that, you've got a very small number of fans buying them, but you're boosting the chart position, particularly because both Justin and Ariana, in their statements on this, pointed out that sales count for more than streams. So it's a really, like, it could have been quite a small number of fans actually engaging with the track. And I mean, who's to say that they wouldn't sit at home playing 4 different CD singles? But let's assume that that's unlikely. And I mean, it's unlikely that they would even have the means to play 1 in this day and age. But that does mean quite a small number of fans engaged with this track right at the last minute and did help it to jump right up to the number one spot, which I think would be a reasonable thing for 6ix9ine to complain about, because that is sort of a manipulation of the charts, albeit within the rules.
It was kind of interesting, wasn't it, how in the statements that Ariana and Justin put out, which didn't actually specifically name 6ix9ine, but both of their statements, and Justin Bieber's in particular, actually really got into the chart rules and the systems that you can employ to boost your chart figures, which Bieber basically referred to as strategy. And it was almost kind of saying, duh, this is how you get a number one. Everyone knows that. More fool you for not doing the same as what we did, was basically what he was saying.
I mean, but you could argue that he did do that. He did try to employ the same tactic. He just didn't do it as well as they did. So 6ix9ine did put a limited edition CD single up for sale on his website at the last minute before the chart cutoff for that week. The difference is he didn't make it US only, he didn't limit it to 4 per customer, and he didn't say he would sign them.
Yeah, what he lacked was strategy.
Yes.
And as a result, he lost the chart battle, and he should just live with that, is basically what Ariana Grande and Justin Bieber were saying. So a little bit of interesting back and forth from some music stars in America this week. Who'd have thought that in 2020... we'd be having a conversation about a chart battle. Turns out artists still care whether or not they get to number one in the Billboard Hot 100.
Well, this is not even our first conversation about a chart battle in recent weeks, although the more recent one was a less angry chart battle. But in terms of US chart positions, this kind of thing has flared up a lot in recent years, usually in the album chart, and as a discussion around a different kind of tactic, so bundling albums with other items to boost your chart position. Nicki Minaj got very angry with Travis Scott when he went to number one above her. She claimed that actually he'd been selling tickets on his website for a tour that hadn't been announced, and bundling the album with that but the fans were buying the tickets. They weren't buying the album, and therefore those album sales, despite being counted, were illegitimate. On the opposite side, DJ Khaled, as I think we've discussed on Setlist, threatened to sue Billboard because they didn't count a number of his bundles, and it meant that he went to number two below Tyler, the Creator, when their albums were out last year. And that actually led to Billboard updating its rules on bundles to be a lot clearer about when you can and when you can't have a bundle counted as a chart position. And it really, it has to be that the album is the thing you're selling, not a ticket or something else with an album attached to it.
Yeah, it remains to be seen whether this particular chart spat results in any further changes to the rules. It has to be said there have been a lot of changes to chart rules in all sorts of ways in recent years, to the extent that from our perspective you get to the point where it's like, why do we even have charts anymore? They've become so complicated, do they even really mean anything? But as we say, certainly in the US, it is very clear that artists, not just old artists, you know, current successful pop stars, all still do care whether or not they get the number one and whether it's a singles chart or the album chart. I mean, the other amusing thing about this particular chart battle story is not only was it pop stars caring deeply whether or not they got to the top of the singles chart, the whole story hinged on the sale of CD singles to the fans of Justin Bieber and Ariana Grande, who can't be a demographic who in any real sense care about the compact disc. And as you've already said, in most cases, probably, given that these days most laptops don't even come with a CD drive, have no actual way to play any of those records.
Yes, you could definitely argue that this was a needless use of plastic in these supposedly more environmentally conscientious times for no real reason at all, because, I mean, although clearly the artists care whether they go to number one or not, beyond their core fan base, I don't think anyone knows. I mean, the only time we know who's at number one in the US is when someone complains about their chart position.
Although, as you've also pointed out a couple of times already, we should also acknowledge that every single one of those CD singles that were sold were raising money for charity. So the environment may have lost, but society at large gained. Meanwhile, poor old 6ix9ine has to just make do with the fact that he was out-strategized by the management team of Bieber and Grande. And next time he's got a new track out, he too will have to come up with some weird, time-limited, signed product gimmick in order to get him to number one.
Well, that's the other thing now, is it like he may have gone to number three, but he doesn't have to sign tens of thousands of CD singles, which I'm sure Justin and Ariana will be doing themselves and not, I don't know, getting a stamp or getting some interns to do it. That would be wrong, and I'm sure they would not do it.
I once knew a quite successful band that when they used to have to do signed stuff, would sign each other's names. Because they would get bored of signing their own names. So maybe Ariana could sign Justin and Justin could sign Ariana for a bit of variety.
Well, that was, I can't remember what band it was now. Possibly Joy Division. I think it might be a Peter Hook story where he'd seen a signed New Order album in a record shop for sale, but it had Ian Curtis' signature on it.
That was a little bit of a an oversight on the fraudster's part.
Yes. On that note, that is all we've got time for on this episode of Setlist. Do all the normal stuff you do when you finish listening to a podcast. Subscribe to it, review it, rate it, email it, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Tell all your friends. The lockdown rules have been relaxed a little bit, so you can see people a bit more now. So when you see them, do remember, first thing you say before you say, "Are you ill?" is, have you listened to the latest episode of Setlist? You really should. So that's the most important thing that you should be thinking of right now. But yes, that is all we've got time for this week. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.